quality of everyday life, and a good part of everyday life for Americans is watching television. So I think it makes sense for us to think about watching TV, and that's what I'd like to do today. For those of you that weren't here the very first time, this phrase, the moral ecology of everyday life, may be a little bit mystifying. A lot of what it has to do with is paying attention to the institutions around us. American culture teaches us to think of ourselves as individuals and to think of ourselves as people who have a tremendous number of autonomous choices. We tend to think most of the time that we determine our own lives. But we act all the time through institutions, and even the choices that we make, even the autonomous choices that we make, are channeled by institutions. And this book is a wonderful book for helping us to think about institutions. And I just, at the beginning, want to read a little bit from a section of the first chapter of The Good Society entitled, Why Americans Have Trouble Understanding Institutions. And here it is. What is missing in this American view of society, which is to say a liberal, individualist view of society? Just the idea that in our life with other people we are engaged continuously through words and actions in creating and recreating the institutions that make that life possible. This process is never neutral, but is always ethical and political, since institutions, even such an intimate institution as the family, live or die by ideas of right and wrong and conceptions of the good. So any institution has conceptions of the good embodied in it, and we'll talk about some of those conceptions of the good in television today. Conversely, while we, in concert with others, create institutions, they also create us. They educate us and form us, especially through the socially enacted metaphors they give us, metaphors that provide normative interpretations of situations and actions. The metaphors may be appropriate or inappropriate, but they are inescapable. Since we are creatures that deal with language, metaphors are the way that we think. A local congregation may think of itself as a family, which is a metaphor. A corporate CEO may speak of management and workers all being team players, another metaphor. Democracy itself is not so much a specific institution as a metaphoric way of thinking about an aspect of many institutions. One more paragraph here. In short, we are not self-created atoms manipulating or being manipulated by objective institutions. We form institutions and they form us every time we engage in a conversation that matters, and certainly every time we act as a parent or child, student or teacher, citizen or official, in each case calling on models and metaphors for the rightness and wrongness of action. So for example, when I go to come into a college classroom with my students on the first day, what I find is that when I enter the room, the classroom gets quiet. Okay. So you just ask, why are you quiet now when you were talking 2 minutes ago? And what you get to very quickly is that we're enacting metaphors, or we're enacting our understanding of the roles of student and teacher. And the roles of student and teacher tell us from the very beginning of our time in education that teachers get to talk and that everybody else has to shut up. There's a wonderful article entitled Kindergarten is Academic Boot Camp, which essentially says kindergarten is the time when, in our education, we have the most fun. You get to finger paint, you get to be messy, you get to run around a lot. In my kids' kindergarten room, there was even a jungle gym, which was just wonderful. But the article says that when the bell rings, you have to sit in a circle and you have to be quiet before sharing time. And so that the sort of structural rule that's enacted in kindergarten is sit down, shut up, and listen. And that's the what we call educating for stupidity that we teach all through American education. So that by the time kids get to college, where I meet them, they have a very hard time asking questions anymore. And I have to try to teach my American studies students to be like four-year-olds. And I do this explicitly. I'll say, my ideal American studies student is a four-year-old. Because a four-year-old is socialized enough to have language, particularly the question why, but not so socialized enough to sort of take everything as common sense. That's the way it is. You know, they want to ask about everything. And so if you can get to be like a four-year-old, you can do great in American studies.
Well, that's the downside of everything you need to know you learned in kindergarten.
That's right. Yeah, right. Everything you need to know. Part of what you learn in kindergarten is to not want to know so much, but only to want to know the things that people want you to know. And that's unfortunate. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about television now. Many of you are familiar faces, and so you know that I'm not doing anything very structured in this talk, and that you can feel free to say something at any time you like. And we can go in all kinds of different ways. Students often think that they've got me off on a tangent when they ask some question that moves me in a direction that I wasn't going at a particular time. But my sense is that in education there aren't really any tangents at all, that everything is a part of the circle, and so we may as well deal with whatever it is that students are concerned with rather than sort of go through some kind of program that I might have in advance. But anyway, watching the moral ecology of television. For some reason, Scripture is mostly silent about television. Without vision, the Old Testament tells us, the people perish. But this does not tell us much about the visions of television. In Matthew and Luke and Mark, Jesus asks the disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane, "Can you not watch 1 hour with me?" But presumably he was not talking about television. Just the same, I'd like to suggest that we watch an hour of TV here in this place where there are no TVs. Before we begin, I want you to just think very quickly about where the TVs are in your house. Okay, so get a visual image of where the TVs are, what rooms the TVs might be in. And now I want you to sort of do a kind of cultural map, or just a sort of cultural geography of that particular room. What do the rooms look like? And how is the furniture arranged in the rooms that have TVs? Okay, you have that image there. Can you still locate your TV after your time here at Holden Village? Most of the time, if you're sort of normal Americans, and unfortunately I think here I'm probably not speaking to an audience of normal Americans, the TV is arranged in such a way that all the furniture faces it. And any anthropologist coming into an American home would think that our TVs are like shrines, with all of the furniture oriented worshipfully in that direction. As one critic said, in America, TV is like religion, except we watch it more religiously. And I think this is true. For my main text today, I would like to use the essay "A Sad Heart at the Supermarket" by the American poet and critic Randall Jarrell. I think that's the correct pronunciation of his name, but it's spelled the same as my last name, so I always pronounce it like it was Farrell or Jarrell. So I'm going to pronounce it that way, but if the correct pronunciation is Jarrell, you can go back to that later on. He wrote this article, "A Sad Heart at the Supermarket," in 1960, after a decade in which supermarkets had become one of the main cultural metaphors in American life. Supermarkets are a relatively recent invention. They first began in the 1930s, but after World War II, they really began to take off, and people began to think that supermarkets were really wonderful. For example, in 1958, at the Brussels World's Fair, the United States displayed an entire supermarket as part of its display of what American culture is about. A 15,000 item supermarket. Now this would be a dwarf of a supermarket now. 15,000 items, nowhere near the amount of items that you'd have in a supermarket now. But it was pretty big then, and they actually did it there, and then they took it to other countries to show them what the American way of life was like. And this was real important in the era of the Cold War and the competition with the Soviet Union to show that Americans had all these goods that they could produce in the American way of life, and the Soviets weren't able to do that. In 1959, when Nikita Khrushchev came to the United States, the premier of the Soviet Union, they took him to a supermarket, a Safeway in San Francisco, as another way of saying, sort of, up yours, Khrushchev. In 1960, Norman Mailer, who was sort of, I think, really one of our fine critics, was sort of looking at politics and trying to figure out the Kennedy phenomenon. And he wrote an essay entitled "Superman Comes to the Supermarket," on the sort of image politics that was important for John Kennedy. So anyway, with this sort of context, Jarrell decided to write this article. And the essay analyzes the media in American culture, examines the relationship between the artist and American society, and discusses by implication the moral ecology of everyday life. 4 years before Marshall McLuhan's Understanding Media popularized the idea that the medium is the message, Jarrell focused on the American media. He went, however, to the root of the issue, the word itself. He looked it up in the dictionary, and he found that medium means, quote, "that which lies in the middle, hence middle condition or degree, a substance through which a force acts or an effect is transmitted, any means, agency, or instrumentality as a medium of communication." any surrounding or pervading substance in which bodies move, hence an environment, or more specifically, a sterilized nutritive substance for cultivating bacteria, viruses, etc. Given this route, Gerald claimed that all the media, television, radio, movies, newspapers, magazines, and the rest, are a single medium in whose depths we are all being cultivated. The medium is of middle condition or degree, mediocre. It lies in the middle of everything, between a man and his neighbor, his wife, his child, his self. But that sentence seems to me to be extraordinary. Between a man and his neighbor, his wife, his child, his self. TV gets between us and ourselves because it gives us images of the selves that TV tells us we ought to be. And so we have these images in ourselves and always trying to adjust ourselves to those images in one way or another. In fact, more and more conscious of ourselves as images also. The medium, he says, more than anything else is the substance through which the forces of society act upon us and make us into what our society needs. And what does it need, he asked, for us to need? And here he's right along with this book that I asked the bookstore to get here, which they do have, Alan Durning's book, How Much is Enough? The Consumer Society and the Future of the Earth, has a wonderful chapter in here on the cultivation of needs. And since Gerald here is talking about cultures and sort of the culturing of people, the way that we cultivate needs is very important, and TV is an important part of that. In the year that John F. Kennedy staked out America's claim to a new frontier, Gerald claimed that in America, the frontier of necessity, which is another phrase that I like a lot, the frontier of necessity is always being pushed forward. The medium shows us what our new needs are, and it shows us how they can be satisfied. They can be satisfied by buying something. The act of buying something is at the root of our world. If anyone wishes to paint the genesis of things in our society, he will paint a picture of God holding out to Adam a checkbook or credit card or charger plate. How quickly our poor naked Adam is turned into a consumer is linked to others by the great chain of buying. Gerald cited, I'm glad you got that. This is an important part of the essay, and I'll come back to that. Gerald cited Emerson's idea that things are in the saddle and ride mankind, but he added that now they are in the theater and studio and entertain mankind, are in the pulpit and preach to mankind. The values of business in a business society like our own are reflected in every sphere. Values which agree with them are reinforced. Values which disagree are canceled out or have lip service paid to them. Television is probably the best contemporary example of the mediation and mediocrity of the consumption ethic and business values. Television is the force through which society acts or an effect is transmitted. It is the nutritive substance, although substance may not be exactly the right word, which cultivates Americans. As an average American, sleep is your primary lifetime activity. Work is second, but watching television is third. The average American watches about 7 nonstop years in a lifetime. Average daily household viewing time in 1989 was more than 7 hours. On the average, you watch TV more than you eat, more than any other leisure activity, and more than any religious or political activity. A 1986 Roper poll found that watching television is the most eagerly anticipated daily activity of 25% of Americans. Between the ages of 5 and 18, average American kids spend 14,000 hours in classrooms, quite an education, but they spend 15,000 hours in front of the TV, where they see 10,000 acts of violence and 350,000 commercials. Television, therefore, is our main educational system. I want to emphasize this. Television is our main educational system. Schools are basically extracurricular. And your attitude toward TV makes no statistical difference. People who dislike TV watch on the average as much as those who like it, and people who complain about TV programming still turn on the TV, not so much to watch a particular show as to watch TV. This seems to me to be a really important thing in American culture, the idea that we simply watch TV and not watch particular programs on it. I mean, you see this all the time. I see it a lot with my kids, that at a certain point where they are feeling bored, they simply will turn on the TV to watch whatever is on, not any particular.
But then there are the people that even turn the TV on and don't even watch it, really pay attention, but it's just a sound background for them.
Right, the sound background is important, and we sort of talked about that a little bit yesterday, that idea that people have a real hard time dealing with silence in American culture, and so the TV is this sort of person, this company that they might have with them. Okay, in some cases, watching TV overlaps with sleep, as a 1975 survey showed that one-fifth of all viewers claim that they watch TV and sleep at the same time. This does not seem possible, but brain research shows how it is possible to sleep and watch TV at the same time. Researchers have found that when people watch TV, within 30 seconds, the brain waves switch from predominantly beta waves, indicating alert and conscious attention, to predominantly alpha waves, indicating an unfocused, receptive lack of attention. The brain's left hemisphere, which processes information logically and analytically, tunes out while the person is watching TV. Now, this is an especially curious fact because at its root, the word watch means the act of keeping awake and alert in order to look after, protect, and guard. Now that's the way in which I want to talk about watching television today. To be alert and thinking about TV, to be awake, to try to guard ourselves about what's coming off in TV. Now what would happen if we watched TV in this root or radical sense? What would happen if we looked at TV as a medium, as a means, agency, or instrumentality and asked, for what? What are the ends for which TV is a means? When I ask my students why we have TV, I usually get two answers. We get entertainment and information. Following Gerald's example, I consult my dictionary and find that entertain comes from roots meaning to hold between, and that it commonly means to hold the attention of, to divert, to amuse. This only provokes more questions. Who is diverting my attention from what and why? I look up inform, since information is the second thing that TV does for it, and I find that its primary meaning is to give form or character to be the formative principle of. And this is what Gerald suspected from the start, that TV informs on the inside of us, it forms us from within the American people, that it makes us what we are, and that it diverts our attention from the way that it performs this information. But we still don't know that the ends for which TV is the means. So let's ask why we are entertained and informed. Why are the programs like 60 Minutes or Roseanne or Murphy Brown on the air? They are there to hold our attention. They are there to hold us between. Between what? Between the ads. We normally think of TV ads as what we put up with to get the programs, but the people who pay for TV think differently. They think of programming as what they have to put up with to get you to watch the ads. Mm. To state it another way, the programs are ads for the commercials. In fact, one TV critic suggests that the programs are just there to keep the ads from bumping together.
You've got that out of the infomercials now, so you get it all in one.
Yeah, now you can get the half-hour infomercials where you can watch the ads without having the distraction of the programming at all, which somehow to me is not progress, but it's there.
It's progress to someone.
Yeah, it is. That's right, it is progress to the people who are selling. Indeed, when you think of TV as a medium, the programming is almost insignificant except as it programs us to watch the ads. In fact, TV stations and networks are basically in the business of renting an audience of potential consumers to advertisers. Television is more demographic than democratic, as critic Les Brown explains. How much an advertiser pays for a 30-second spot depends not so much on how many viewers tune in, but on the quality of those viewers. Now, the term quality is just wonderful in this context. Affluent young adults being preferred, women between 18 and 49, for example, watching during prime time on Fridays, sell for $16.50 per thousand. Older women and teenagers who buy less sell for less than that. And that's why the Nielsen ratings are important. We see the Nielsens in the paper every week. In the Star Tribune, they come out on Wednesdays or Thursdays. And we think of them as telling us what programs we should watch if we want to get into coffee break conversations the next day, since coffee break conversations are very often about TV programs of the night before. But the Nielsens are the network's way of knowing what they can charge advertisers. In 1977, the number one show was Happy Days, with an average weekly audience of 52 million people, 22 million of whom were in the prime spending 18 to 49 age group. ABC charged advertisers $60,000 for 30 seconds of time, and that doesn't cost the count. That doesn't count the cost of the commercial itself. By 1986, which is the last date I have information for, 30 seconds of prime time was $118,000, roughly double of what it had been in 1977. Now, the interesting thing, though, is that many 30 and 60 second commercials cost more to make than the half hour programs which they allegedly sponsor. And this is true. And if you want to see the care with which these commercials are constructed, read Michael Arlen's book, 30 Seconds. It's called 30 Seconds because it's an entire book on the making of the first AT&T reach out and touch someone commercial for long distance. And what he shows there is that up until that time, long distance had been looked on as bad news. People wouldn't make long distance calls, and they didn't like long distance calls because it normally meant that your grandmother had died or something like that. It was, long distance was a way of conveying bad news. And so since AT&T wanted people to make more long distance calls and to sort of raise their telephone bills, they had to change the image of long distance. And so they needed to do this with a commercial. And they picked this theme of reach out and touch someone, this sort of kind of gushy theme. In order to do that. And they hired a director to do it, and they shot 10,000 feet of film in order to do this 30-second commercial, and they used 44 feet of it. They shot it over a period of 6 months, I think, and it was an extraordinarily expensive kind of thing to do, but it worked. I mean, people now have changed their idea about long distance. And many times, I find with my kids, I'll have a harder time getting them away from the TV when the commercials are on than when the programming is on. And it's because the commercials are more visually interesting. They're just better, I mean, in terms of what do you call quality TV commercials? That's an oxymoron, I think. Quality TV. But in terms of the finesse of TV, they're better than the programs.
Excuse me, are you going to talk about zapping? Because zapping seems to contradict that.
Yeah, if you can do, and in fact, that's one of the things that the networks are really worried about now is zapping, and it may eventually be that we'll lose commercial TV because of zapping. Networks now are not able to attract the audiences that they now have because of cable, and that's a problem to them. I think we're going to have some major changes in television in American culture because cable changes a lot, and the VCR also changes a lot. I'm not going to talk a whole lot about that now because I want to just focus mainly on commercial television.
Well, I was going to say that now I found that when you want to, if you want to watch commercials once and you switch to another channel, they have them have the exact same time, every single channel.
Oh, yeah.
All you do is go from commercial to commercial at 10 after or 20 after, is you don't get a different show.
That's right. I mean, you don't.
They've got me right around people trying to switch.
A little bit, although you could still sort of pre-record stuff and then watch it later in the evening and then zap the commercials. And I must admit, there's a great pleasure in zooming past those commercials when you're watching something on the VCR. Now, historically, advertising and television have helped to adapt Americans to the post-war age of affluence, said motivation researcher Ernest Dichter in the early 50s. We are now confronted with the problem of permitting the average American to feel moral even when he's spending, even when he's not saving, even when he is taking two or three vacations a year and buying a second or third car. One of the basic problems of prosperity, then, is to demonstrate that the hedonistic approach to life is a moral, not an immoral one. And television was the ideal medium for solving this problem of permission. Advertising, which is then the main programming of American television, requires a certain kind of show. And the shows are really shaped to go with the advertising, a certain kind of setting. A vice president of programming for ABC revealed that, quote, program makers are supposed to devise and produce shows that will attract mass audiences without unduly offending those audiences or too deeply moving them emotionally. Such ruffling, it is thought, will interfere with the ability to receive, recall, and respond to the commercial message. This programming reality is the unwritten, unspoken assumption of all professional members of the television fraternity. And you can see this when you see when a controversial show, for example, shows up on television. You can see this because they don't get advertisers for it, and that's in the papers, you know. So-and-so, who normally sponsors the Hallmark Hall of Fame, has withdrawn their advertising for this show because it deals with abortion or something like that. or one that I saw, a beautiful show several years ago, which I think was on the Hallmark Hall of Fame. No, it wasn't on that because it wasn't sponsored by Hallmark, but it was on one of these sort of quality theater things on TV. It was a movie called Playing for Time, in which I think Vanessa Redgrave played a prisoner in the Holocaust, and the way that she was able to keep from being killed in the Holocaust was by playing music for the camp commander, who liked to have an orchestra of prisoners, and so she was literally playing for time. And in the course of this movie, you see her get more and more gaunt, and she's really dying. And in the middle of this, there's an ad for one of these skin creams that takes spots off your hand. And it was just incredible to see this, you know. I mean, here you are talking about these life and death situation, and then this thing for skin cream to take spots off your hand. And it seemed at that time so trivial and so insignificant. Now, most of the time, these things don't seem trivial and insignificant because they're matched perfectly with trivial and insignificant shows. And the shows need to be structured in that way in order to do that. Now, TV plays fantasies of fascinating life at the same time that it makes our own lives less fascinating. Why don't, for example, characters on TV watch TV? You know, you would think that if they were going to be anything about American life, they'd watch TV a lot. And it is the reason that they don't is because it would be boring to watch what we do. It would be boring to watch us watching TV. Now, these programs that are on TV are all pre-tested also. And they're all pre-tested by a place called Preview House in Los Angeles. This is NBC and ABC test theirs there, where they invite in audiences, say, we might be the audience for this, and they give you a thing that you can turn to say what the quality of the program is at any given time. You're supposed to turn it for the whole half hour that a program is on. This is where they test their pilot programs. Now, to sort of standardize the audiences, these things are called in the industry the Magoos, because they show a Mr. Magoo cartoon at the beginning of this thing, and you're supposed to be turning this thing around. Everything that comes on, ads, the shows, everything, are rated by the Magoos, and so you're turning this, and so they use the Magoo thing to sort of standardize whether or not you're a really receptive audience or that sort of thing, and then they adjust all the scores in relation to that, and then they play the pilot, and what they do is they play the pilot, and people write the pilot so that they can get high Magoos, because that helps you get the pilot sold. And they find that, for example, anytime you put dogs on, you get high Magoos, and small children give you high Magoos. Car wrecks and action scenes with cars get you high Magoos. Violence gets you high Magoos. And so you just sort of, you have these categories of things that they know will get you high Magoos, and they all show up in the pilots for these programs. And it's very hard to get around that kind of standardization of these audiences that are sitting there dialing all these things. And you don't get your programs on the air if they don't get good reviews in these things called the Magoos.
Do those have ads in them when the preview audience?
Yeah, they do the ads too, because the ads are in many ways pre-tested. They want to know what it is that people like about the ads. And they do this in politics, too. If any of you have watched the public TV series that Bill Moyers did called The Public Mind, you can see them doing the Magoos, essentially, with Ronald Reagan speeches. They have a deal that's rigged up so that you see the president on there giving his speech, and then you see on the screen also the bar graph showing how the audience is responding to everything that he's saying, so that when he says a word like family, it's things go up like that. And Reagan was great at using these metaphors, family, neighborhood, that sort of thing, in his speeches. The people who have studied the rhetoric of Ronald Reagan have seen the way in which he, in a way, adapted his rhetoric to the Magoos. Not, I think, consciously. I think he had been doing that for so long that he was good at it. I mean, he started in TV in 1953 or something like that. But so he knew what these words were like. But they do shape the audiences like that. And you see Michael Deaver on this show, The Public Mind, just explicitly saying how they manipulated people to do things. And another thing that they found in marketing TV candidates is that image was everything. There's a piece on there with Leslie Stahl where they had done this thing with all the balloons and flags and all this sort of stuff with the president. And Leslie Stahl, who was the CBS reporter at it, said on the air, "This is really pretty stupid. There's no content in here. This is just a show for the American public." But what Michael Deaver found when he did the research about it is that nobody paid any attention at all to Leslie Stahl. The words don't compete with the images. Images are much more important on TV than the words. And
well, Jim, the other reason I ask that is that it seems to me that the television shows have to be written in such a, into those segments. You know, as this man said, if you flip, they're all commercials.
That's right.
All the channels at the same time. And that one of the things that is unreal about television is that, you know, you're sort of thinking, oh, well, this is getting a little scary, but 8 minutes, it's going to be okay. These nice segments. So that if you ever watch a TV show without the commercials, there are these odd breaks.
That's right.
In the action.
Right.
So that I just wondered if you could rate it without having something in those breaks.
No, you need to have the stuff in the breaks, and they want to rate the stuff that's in the breaks, too, because that's the main programming anyway. You raised another issue, though, that has to do with politics also, and that's that since TV operates mainly in terms of series, which are either 30 minutes or an hour, in which everything gets resolved, unless maybe there's a two-part thing, you know, continued next week, which frustrates audiences quite a lot. We get used to the idea that any problem can be solved in 30 minutes. We also get used to the idea on TV that all problems are individual problems. You very seldom find a TV show in which people get involved politically to do anything, because politics is kind of messy and it's time-consuming and it takes a while to get organized, and so people don't do that. The only problems that show up on TV are problems that can be resolved by the individual cast of characters, and so the sort of underlying message of TV is that politics is not something that you get engaged in. In fact, I'll talk about this a little bit later. The messages of TV are one problem for the American public. Another problem for the American public is what TV doesn't say. Part of the problem is what it does say, part of the problem is what it doesn't say. There's a lot that's not on TV, and we are taught very effectively by what we are not taught. We are taught by what we are taught that what we are taught is important and what we are not taught is not important. And this has a lot to do with education. You know, what constitutes the canon? The canon is one way of saying what's important, and if it's not in the canon, if something's not in the canon, then it's said, then it's implicitly it's not important. Same thing goes for TV. If it's not on TV, it's not important. And so, for example, there are very few ads or even sitcoms that are set in South Bronx or in Bosnia, for example. It's hard to set a sitcom in Bosnia or South Bronx. There are very few ads that come out of South Bronx because we don't want to see those kinds of scenes. Those people are invisible on TV, and they become invisible to us in our lives. What is visible on TV is mostly American middle class life, and that gets reinforced over and over and over again by the TV. Now, news is also problematic on TV. We think sometimes, well, the entertainment may be junk, but the news is substantial. I want to suggest this is not true. Normally, a half-hour network news show contains 15 to 20 stories, quote, stories, averaging 60 seconds each. The in-depth stories are usually about 180 seconds on TV. 180 seconds for an in-depth story on a 30-minute news show.
How does that compare with McNeil Lehrer? I mean, what's the length of their stories?
Well, they essentially do one story a night, and so they're doing.
Sometimes they do three.
Well, but you see, then you got 10 minutes for each, or even, you know, 15 or 20 minutes, and then do two shorter ones. So you get more on McNeil Lehrer. I still don't find that satisfactory either. Or 60 minutes, which is the number one rated program a lot of the time, seems to me to be a real problematic show since it. It seldom looks at things structurally. It tends to look for individual CEOs who are evil, which is pretty much fitting within the genre of TV programming anyway.
TV scandal sheet.
Yeah, I mean it is that. So when you watch a 30-minute TV show, you get 15 stories in 22 minutes because there are only 22 minutes of programming there. The other 8 minutes is ads. You have to remember that. And 15 stories in 22 minutes is very hard to remember. And studies show that most people forget the news almost entirely within 30 minutes. The stories are hard to think about since we get so little so fast. They're even harder to feel about, since the same music frames the show, the station breaks, and the commercials, regardless of a particular day's news, and the anchor will say it in the same tone of voice, whether 100 million people have been killed or whether two have been killed, except in some very rare occasions. There was one time in 1968 where Walter Cronkite blew up on the air about the government lying to us over the Tet Offensive, and that was a scandal that he should do that. But most of the time, those people are very carefully trained not to express emotions on the air. It's also...
What about this issue, though, when some really big thing happens, but there's sort of this obsession about it for a long period of time, and it seems like it dominates everything?
Well, actually, there's an obsession with it, I'd say, for a short period of time. Yeah. When something big happens...
longer than 180 seconds.
Yeah, longer than 180 seconds. It dominates stuff, and they start putting on then shows like Nightline, which come on after your local news to deal with this special thing. Now, Nightline can be a useful kind of thing because they get to interview people there and they go into more depth than they do on the news. But Nightline, in some crisis situations, is a way of reporting that nothing has happened. They spent 22 minutes reporting that nothing has happened. And the best example of this that I can think of was during the Iranian hostage crisis in 1979, which is when they started Nightline. And most of the time in the Iranian hostage crisis, nothing happened, Every day the hostages were still there. There were some negotiations about it, but they didn't get out and they didn't get killed. So they were just there. So Nightline was essentially coming on every night to say, this is day 277 of the hostage crisis and nothing happened. And we're going to talk about it for 22 minutes. So it's 22 minutes of conversation about nothing. And even then, I was watching some of these nothings. They were extraordinarily bad at putting it in context. They very seldom talked about, say, the Iranian Revolution of 1951 or 50, I can't remember, it was in the early 50s anyway. Very seldom talked about that on Nightline. It's all sort of current sort of stuff. And this is one of the problems with the news, is that it's all new. It has to be. This is what news is supposed to be. It is the news. And if it isn't new, it doesn't count. History doesn't get on the news. And so what you get is what Neil Postman calls decontextualized information. And that's one reason why it's so bad. I had a student in the Paracollege once at St. Olaf who decided that she could do better than the CBS Evening News. And so what we did is we taped Dan Rather's CBS Evening News broadcast and looked at all the different things that were on there. And then Ann said, I can do better than that. I'll take those stories that were on there. This was in the early 80s when there was a lot of stuff going on in El Salvador, Nicaragua, and things like that. And they presented the El Salvador story, and then they did another story, and then they did a Nicaragua story, and then they did another story, and then they did a story on Guatemala. So these were just all isolated events. Well, Ann took the three of those stories and put them together, put them in the context of American foreign policy towards Central America, and put that in the historical context of American exploitation and corporate involvement in Latin America over a century. And in the same amount of time, in 22 minutes, she produced a broadcast that was intellectually much more interesting than Dan Rather had done at all. And there were some other things in there about businesses failing and the sort of business cycle. And she clumped all those together, too, and talked about the American economy. And really did a wonderful job contextualizing the information. So
how
in terms of...
How long did it take her to do that, to prepare?
It took her about a week. Because she had to do then all the film editing and everything, because she had to tape stuff off the TV news in order to get sort of background film that went behind her stuff, and then she had to get an anchor desk and dress up in a suit and all that sort of stuff. It took her about a week to do it, but you would figure that a professional TV operation ought to be able to do that in a day if they were any good at all.
Probably stepped on a few potential advertisers' foot.
Oh, she did. Well, she also did advertisers. She was a 22-minute thing. It had to be real. So she did ads, and she did these spoofs of ads that are on TV. One of them was it must have been in 1984 because there were all these Olympic ads on, and she did one for the official menstrual cycle of the Olympics. And her brother was a paraplegic who had always wanted to do an ad on TV, and there's this really obnoxious car ad in the Twin Cities for Viking Chevrolet, or there was at that time. This guy just is shouting at you about, come right down now, buy your Chevrolet here, it's the best deal you could possibly get, all this sort of thing. So her brother sat in a wheelchair and did the same sort of thing for a wheelchair. You know, get your wheelchair right now, right down here, the 1984 wheelchair. Then she had another ad, one of these ads where there was some phone number that you had to call to do it. She put my phone number, my home phone number.
And she's got it flashing on and off like that. It was just wonderful. But she did a great job of it. Now, another thing that network news does is it gives us lots and lots of information, but really kind of trivial information. And it changes what Neil Postman calls the information-action ratio. We get more and more information in this country, but it's almost all information that we have no response to. Sort of, I mean, think about the last time that you watched the news and got up afterwards and said, I'm going to do something about that. You don't do that. I mean, we're cultured to watch the news and not do anything about it. Culture to watch the news and figure, well, I know that. This is my civic duty. Now I know, but nothing happens as a result of it. About the only time that the news ever changes people's behavior is when it's the news, sports, and weather, and the weather sometimes does because it's going to be cold out, so you go out early and start your car or whatever it is that you do. But very seldom is there any action that comes of the news.
Janet just pointed out that in that series, you remember the ads more than the
Yeah, that's true. those ads were exquisite, though. You would have remembered them, too.
Jim, I think it's really interesting that to reflect on what happens to people when we come to Holden is, by and large, people don't pay attention to the news for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and we don't miss it.
Right.
You know, if something really, you know, so we bombed Baghdad. People find that out 2 days later, 3 days later, and we're kind of like, oh, gee. But again, we don't, it's not that we feel that we're really missing something by not hearing the news.
Well, I think part of the reason for that is that the news is, there's a two ways of thinking about sponsors for the news. One is to think about it in the conventional way, where the sponsors are the people who are the advertisers that are on there. Another way to think about it is the way that Robert Emtman does in a book called Democracy Without Citizens. He says that the sponsors of the news are the people who essentially put out the press releases that invite people to come and do stories about them. So the sponsors of the news are almost always the major political parties and the major players in American politics. The president gets covered no matter what he does. And presidential candidates get covered no matter what they do. I remember in 1988, there was a day in which Dukakis and Reagan were preparing for debates, which meant essentially they were doing nothing. But they both wanted to have photo opportunities because they wanted to be on the news that night. So Reagan went out and walked along a fence at his ranch and might have patted a horse or something like that. And they showed him patting a horse on there and said that he was preparing for the debates. And Dukakis did something else. I can't remember what it was. But again, it was the coverage of nothing. But they had invited the reporters out to cover this nothing on what they assured them would be a good photo opportunity. And the visuals had to be there. They wouldn't have done it if Reagan had actually been sitting reading a book of his debate preparations, because that would be dull TV. But patting a horse, that's got good magoos, and so you know, the news has to pay attention to the magoos too, because it is a commercial operation, and they are also selling an audience to advertisers.
What do you make of the fact that the coverage of the LA riot created a lot of change in people's behavior? As a matter of fact, one of the accusations is that because they were so much on the scene, that there were actually people that listened to their TV, saw where the action was, and went there and broke in, or in one case, rescued Reginald Denny. But I think that's an unusual thing.
That's right.
But how do you...
I think there are occasions for that. And it seems to me they need to be extreme occasions. And it also needs to be an occasion where the people are acting. Most of the time, what happens when we see the president or advisors or people like that interviewed on there is we assume somebody else is taking care of this. You know, if we have a problem in Bosnia, we figure, well, you know, Clinton will figure something out, and those guys know more than we do, because after all, they're being interviewed on TV and we're not. So they must be important.
I mean, I just thought, to look back, I'm not so sure you can blame people except to understand in retrospect that the mistakes were made and you ought not to make those again, but
yeah.
I mean, they would actually give addresses. Well, here we are at La Cienega, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, that's really
cool. Yeah.
Come on down.
Yeah.
Like in the civil rights demonstrations, you know, people would go demonstrate one side or the other, then run home to see themselves on TV.
Yeah. I have another question about the non-news. One of the things that happened right before I came up to Holden was that there was a rather large earthquake. Well, earthquakes are always big news in California. But it was out in the middle of the desert, and it was eastern Mojave desert. They spent the entire day interviewing people and trying to get some news out of that, and there was nothing there. Now, I can't imagine why they would continue, they would, I mean, just because they sent a reporter out there, it's like, well, you know, they'd go into a gas station. You feel the earthquake? No. Know anybody that fell? You called around? No, I. They kept trying to milk that for all it was worth, and they spent an entire day trying to get some news about this earthquake, which was about, I don't know, was it 6 point or something? Do you remember that, Ken?
Yeah.
But they couldn't get any news, but they spent an awful lot of money trying to get some news out of it.
But they have a low budget, and they blew it all on this reporter out there.
Well, there was more than one reporter. There must have been a whole, and it was absolutely in an inaccessible spot. I mean, you couldn't drive to the earthquake epicenter.
Well, that's when you get to take your helicopter out. And actually, what you then show on the news is the helicopter, because the helicopter is an action thing.
Yeah, because they're...
We do that in Minnesota a lot. You take the helicopter out, and then you show the helicopter landing at some place where you ask people if anything happened, and the answer is no. And so the event actually then is the coverage of the news, and it reassures us that the people are out there looking into everything, whether or not it's important.
That's the same way in Seattle when they're waiting for the winter storm to come. Yeah, 4 days of waiting for the storm before the snow gets there.
Yeah. So there are probably better things that we could do than to watch the news.
Well, TV is called a medium because it's almost never rare or well done.
but actually when you think about that, there's a news reporter in Minneapolis who's a member of our church, and he talks about the kinds of things he's supposed to do, the sort of human events kinds of things, and he spends an extraordinary amount of time for about 30 seconds of airtime, and that must get frustrating after a while to spend, you know, 4 or 5 hours doing a story if I had only 30 seconds on the air, and then if you really sat back and thought about it, probably relatively insignificant for most of the people who watched it. I have a long section here I'm going to skip because I don't know what the time is, and as those of you who know, when we talked about time, I don't wear a watch, but, and we need to be out of here because there's a session in here after, but if people want to, we can just kind of migrate up to the plaza and talk a little bit more. So I'm going to just skip one section, and if you want to know what's in there, ask me later. As part of the moral ecology of everyday life, television has contradictory meanings and effects. Richard Flax suggests that TV is a medium of sociability and also an escape from the strains of interpersonal encounter. It allows family members to be together, but it reduces the need for them to deal with each other. It has made available cheaply a tremendous range of professional entertainment and culture, and thus reduces the boredom and loneliness faced by people with few material resources. This, I think, is very important. TV watching is highest among low-income people. It's also very high among old people. And this seems to me to be one of the services that TV does provide. It is at the same time incontrovertibly a vast wasteland of trivia and vulgarity whose emotional impact is similar to other forms of cheap self-indulgence. Television provides an opportunity for choice and control over one's experience, while it represents a form of controlled leisure and consumption that more than any other packaged mode of entertainment erases initiative and undermines imagination. It provides information about and generates interest in topics, issues, and experiences that might be completely unknown to the millions, while drawing away patronage from previously flourishing forms of community-based mass entertainment and recreation. And one of the nice things about Holden is that we do those community-based kinds of entertainment and information here because we're not all in our rooms at night watching TV. It provides an escape from reality, and we have made it our reality. In the movie Network, anchorman Howard Beale tells his audience that you people sit there night after night. You're beginning to believe this illusion we're spinning here. You're beginning to think that the tube is reality and your own lives are unreal. This is mass madness. And indeed it is, because it is in fact true. George Gerbner, the dean of University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School of Communication, shows that heavy watchers of primetime TV receive, quote, a grossly distorted picture of the real world that they tend to accept more readily than reality itself. For example, on primetime TV, men outnumber women 3-1, and women are typecast as lovers or mothers, passive people dependent on their relationship to men. Only 20% of married women with children work in TV land versus 50% in the real world. And these skewed perceptions, says Gerbner, reinforce sexism. Heavy TV watchers tend to be more sexist than people who don't watch as much. The same patterns hold for depictions of old age, which is almost universally depicted as a horrible thing on TV. For treatments of black people, for the depiction of work, where we largely see managerial, professional, middle-class work for fear of crime, which is 10 times more common on TV than it is in real life. But actually, 55% of primetime characters are involved in violence once a week. It seems like a, and heavy watchers of TV, having watched all this violence, have unrealistic fears of victimization. They think that they are likely to be mugged in the same way that the people on TV are mugged. What we think is simply light entertainment has some fairly heavy effects. From my perspective as a watcher of TV, it has several important implications for the moral ecology of everyday life. Television, which is America's main educational system, has a peculiar relationship to nature also, as Bill McKibben shows in The Age of Missing Information, which is also in the bookstore over here. McKibben taped every program of the nation's largest cable system, which is 105 channels, I think, for 24 hours, and he watched all of it to find out what TV, I think he's a masochist, actually.
Yeah.
He watched all of it to see what TV teaches us. And then McKibben also took a 24-hour trip up a mountain near his home and compared the information of that trip, the information of nature, to what he calls the missing information of television. He concludes that in America, television teaches us mainly that we are disconnected from the earth, which we usually are when we are watching in our climate-controlled homes and recreational vehicles. Even nature specials, he says, which contribute a great deal to our appreciation of the creation, focus on those species which are most like people and on the most active aspects of those animals. They change our expectations of nature. They do not show us lions asleep most of the day, which is what lions do most of the day, any more than sitcoms and soap operas show us people watching television all the time. The upshot of nature education by television, says McKibben, is a deep fondness for certain species and a deep lack of understanding of systems or of the policies that destroy those systems. It is an extraordinary irony, he notes, that in the midst of the information age, most people lack the basic information about plants and animals that was common knowledge a century ago. On TV, the creation is presented to us in anthropocentric terms that make it difficult for us to see the whole story. If TV were to make the Book of Genesis into a miniseries, says McKibben, people would be created on day one. And Noah's Ark would be filled with zany folks. Not much room for animals, especially the boring ones. On TV, people are everything. Most cultures historically have put something else, God or nature or some combination, at the center. But we've put God and nature at the periphery. A consumer society doesn't need them to function, and it can't tolerate the limits they might impose. There's only need for people. As America's primary educational institution, television teaches us that our extravagant and excessive patterns of consumption are perfectly normal, because the characters in most television sitcoms consume pretty much in the same way that we do. But God didn't create just people. She created the world, and she gave it to people for their needs and for their care, and not for any damn thing they might want. And this, says McKibben, is the most important question of the late 20th century. How much is enough? This is also the title of Alan Derning's book, How Much is Enough? Consumer Society and the Future of the World. Television tells us that there is no such thing as enough. I've often thought of writing the American Heritage Dictionary and simply asking them to take the word enough out. It doesn't belong in there. It's not a word that's used in American society, hardly at all. But
like
God,
talking about somebody else.
Yeah. But God and Christianity tell us differently. There is such a thing as enough. Consider the lilies of the field. Television is problematic for the messages it conveys to the American people, but it is also problematic for the messages it does not convey. We learn from what we are taught and from what we are not taught. As I mentioned before, there are the invisible poor. Most issues of justice in this country do not appear on television. You can't set sitcoms in Bosnia or South Bronx. Television is one of the essential institutions of distraction in American culture, one of the institutions which keep us from the work of reflection and wisdom by keeping us programmed to the programming. In this way, in a way, we are the programs of TV. Another effect of television on the moral ecology of everyday life is passivity. And we'll talk a little bit more about this on Saturday. Because television is a one-way street into the audience's mind, it socializes us to be spectators rather than actors in life. Because television consumes so much of our time, it takes time away from other forms of sociability that might lead to community or social justice. Television has its opportunity costs. The time we spend on TV is time not spent on other things. Many of them traditions described by Adrian Rich. This is a long quotation. I'm going to just end with it, even though it's really not a, it's not the ending that I want for this talk, but it's where I'm going to stop. The television screen has throughout the world replaced, or is fast replacing, and here's a list: oral poetry, old wives' tales, children's story acting games and verbal lore, lullabies, playing the sevens, political argument, the reading of books too difficult for the reader yet somehow read, tales of when I was your age told by parents and grandparents to children, linking them to their own past, singing in parts, memorization of poetry, the oral transmitting of skills and remedies, reading aloud, recitation, both community and solitude. People grow up who not only don't know how to read, a late acquired skill among the world's majority, they don't know how to talk, to tell stories, to sing, to listen and remember, to argue, to pierce an opponent's argument, to use metaphor and imagery and expired exaggeration in speech. People are growing up in the slack flicker of a pale light, which lacks the concentrated burn of a candle flame or oil wick, or the bulb of a gooseneck desk lamp, a pale, wavering, oblong shimmer, emitting incessant noise, which is to real knowledge or discourse what the manic or weepy protestations of a drunk are to responsible speech. There are so many opportunities we have for doing things, and so many of them are lost with TV, and so many of them are present here at Holden, where there are no TVs. So I'll stop there, and we can think about some other things that might concern us with TV.
Well, one thing is that corporate TV, as you know, there are a lot of signs that it's on the way home. And between things like cable, VCR, and as we heard earlier, virtual reality,
yeah,
are crowding into the market. The natural monopoly that they held when there were only 12 stations, or maybe 60 with UHF, it disappeared.
Everybody can get into business, but they're still going to need to be selling or renting audiences, I think. So it doesn't seem to me that all of the revolutions in technology are going to give us better TV. Again, that's better TV sounds to me almost like an oxymoron. although I don't want to say that there's not such a thing as good TV. It seems to me that there are some things on TV that are worth the time that you spend to watch them.
Do you have any comments on comparative TV, like Europe, Germany, England?
I don't know a lot about that. What I do know, and what Durning points out here, is that there's been a lot of deregulation of TV in Europe and in other countries, and that half the programming in the world is American sitcom reruns. So what Durning points out here is that American TV is not just American TV. American TV is world TV.
It was interesting when I was in Stockholm years ago, I was watching, they were basically American shows on their public TV. They have a lot of filler they had to put up for all the commercials.
That's right, you're right. Since they don't have
every show, there'd be filler.
Yeah.
When radio was a popular medium prior to television back in the 30s and 40s, were there same types of arguments? Do you recall, but would you have any knowledge about that? In other words, was there the concern about how people were getting mesmerized by this box?
Yeah, there was. The Frankfurt School of sort of criticism really begins in the period of radio, and makes some of the same kinds of criticisms that I'm making today with radio. To me, it seems radio allows more room for the imagination than TV does, and so I don't feel as critical of kinds of radio, of radio drama and things like that. I find radio talk shows to be, for the most part, just awful. And most of the music programming on TV or on radio doesn't make me a whole lot happier.
Well, somebody asked Garrison Keillor once about the advantages of radio, and he pointed out that for almost no cost, you go from Antarctica to the desert.
Right.
Any situation you want to just buy sound effects.
Another thing that was really interesting about radio, and it's connected to Garrison Keillor. Garrison Keillor once said on radio that he had a face made for radio, which he does. I mean, he's not a particularly handsome man. And one of the things that's true of TV is that you need to be handsome or beautiful in a very conventional sense to be on there. And in fact, in his book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, Neil Postman says that a fat man will never be elected president of the United States. I think that's true. And in fact, when Al Gore was thinking of running for the presidency in 1992, the first thing he did was go on a diet. He lost 15 pounds, and then he decided not to run, and so put the weight back on. But, and you know, Clinton's weight has been an issue at various times in here, and all these hamburgers that he eats and things like that, and people look at him, he looks a little pudgy when he goes out running and things like that. He needs to look presidential, and presidential means being sort of conventionally handsome. And I presume it will mean being conventionally beautiful for women when they begin to run for the presidency also.
How do you suspect that interactive television will change things? You said one of the biggest problems with television is that it's a one-way street into people's minds. If there are things like interactive games through television, how do you suspect that will change society or television itself?
Well, I think it'll make people in a way more interested in TV.